Welcome to episode 54 of the Hunt Backcountry podcast, presented to you by Exo Mountain Gear. On this week's show, our guest is Chris Maxwell, and we dive into the topic of guided hunts. Yeah, guided hunts. I know what you're thinking. You're a do-it-yourself guy, public land guy, over-the-counter guy. Guess what? I'm right there with you, and guess what? So is our guest. But there's times and there's a place for a guided hunt, and you'll hear about that today. More importantly, even if you don't think a guided hunt is in your future, if you hunt long enough, I bet that it might be. There's times when you get into certain species or want to hunt certain areas, and going guided is the only way to go. So, whether this is a topic that you're interested in now, or just something that you think might possibly could be in your future, you are going to learn some essential information tonight about how to start that process and what to even consider on a guided hunt. I, like you, am years away from considering a guided hunt, but I thoroughly enjoyed this episode and learned a lot for what to think through down the road. Big thanks to Chris for joining us, and big thanks to you, the listener, for your feedback that you can always send us at any time to podcast@exomountaingear.com, and huge thank you for the reviews on iTunes. If you're enjoying this show, please consider going to iTunes and leaving us a review. It helps tremendously. Okay, we'll wrap up with some more after the show, but for now, here's our discussion with Chris Maxwell. All right, well, Chris, welcome to the show. How are you doing tonight?
Good, thanks, Mark.
Yeah, thanks for coming on with us. Excited to talk about a bunch of topics tonight. Just to get started off, could you kind of introduce yourself to the listeners, give us a little bit of background on hunting history and whatever personal history you'd like to share that's relevant?
Yeah, sure. So I'm probably different than most of your guests. I'm from Canada, and lucky enough to be in Alberta, where we can hunt the backcountry and sheep and whatnot with over-the-counter tags. I cut my teeth, I guess, growing up in Saskatchewan, primarily hunting whitetail and mule deer and antelope, like most people from the prairie regions do. And after I got finished school, I moved out to Alberta here, and I guess I haven't looked back, so been here ever since.
Yeah, there's some monster bucks up there in the plains of Saskatchewan, right?
Yeah, growing up, guys shooting 160-inch deer, probably don't get a second look most of the time, and definitely have seen a lot of 180-plus type whitetails and lots of friends that have got some really exceptional deer and stuff. So it's a great place to come from if you're a deer hunter, for sure.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yep.
So, you mentioned sheep. You actually have hunted sheep quite a bit. As you mentioned, you can do it yourself. You have multiple years of experience doing that. What was kind of that learning curve going from the plains of Saskatchewan to then getting into sheep country and trying to figure those critters out?
Yeah, so when I first moved to Alberta, I had no interest in hunting sheep whatsoever, and I thought, oh, maybe a moose or an elk one day would be great, but, a sheep never even crossed my mind. And a really good friend of mine actually had worked for an outfitter for a few years when he was just out of school, and I'd reconnected with him, and he had worked up in the Wilmore, and that's a huge wilderness area in northern Alberta, and, there's no development in there. It's basically foot and horse access only, and it's like tens and tens of thousands of acres. And so he talked me into going with him on a sheep hunt, but it wasn't going to be in an area where he had worked with his outfitter. We were going to go to this new area that he'd always wanted to try and looked good to him. And long story short, we packed our stuff up with probably everything but the kitchen thing, or I had everything but the kitchen sink, things that I thought, just in case, and this is a nice to have. So I, went in there with a pretty ignorant, really, with 80, 90 pound backpack. And
don't worry, it's only sheep country.
Yeah, that's exactly. No big deal. And long story short, the trip was a disaster from the time we hit the trailhead to the time we decided to turn back. And, you know, I don't think we even really made it to the mountain at that. We could see, like, it was so close we could see it. But my friend I was hunting with there, he had an accident and hurt himself. And then I was getting worn out from carrying this ridiculously heavy pack. So we were, like, after about 2 days, we were turned back. And then that's when I realized, you know, sheep hunting isn't easy. This isn't going to be like a deer hunt where you just go out and get one.
Yeah.
It was way more difficult than I thought it was going to be. And then I was on a mission to figure things out and hunt them properly and learn more and go back and try it again. And, you know, I think it was a solid 7 years before I finally decided to pull the trigger on one. And I could have gotten a couple earlier, but they were just young rams. They were legal, but they were not really what you want to take for a sheep. Like, I was more interested in getting an older mature ram, and being fortunate enough to have over the counter tags, I was able to just pass on some of those younger rams without really regretting it later. And that's kind of how I got into it anyways. And like I said, the first trip was a complete debacle, and I sure had a lot to learn coming from.
I think
from...
that's the first for most of us, regardless of the species, you know?
Like, yeah,
for sure.
Like the first, I'm going to head into the wilderness and figure this thing out, and it can't be that hard, you know?
Yeah, and I probably made the number one biggest rookie mistake. Well, I guess like my friend that I was with, he had hunted out in there, you know, a lot, and he should have known better, but we made like probably the biggest mistake any first time backcountry hunter could make is we went back there. We had a pocket full of tags because, like I was mentioning, a lot of our stuff's on general season, so deer, elk, etc. So we brought like probably enough food for 3 solid days, and our idea was, oh, well, we really want to get an elk as well, so we'll, you know, make a kill right away when we get into our base camp and kind of rely on that, right?
And just sustenance hunting.
Yeah, so thus, even if we would have made it back where we wanted to go, we wouldn't have been able to stay there very long. So
you just carry the elk with you as you hunt and look for sheep, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and like I said, it was, you know, we were pretty young at the time and definitely inexperienced and didn't know what we didn't know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So a couple quick questions that, you know, it's kind of popped in my head about what you came up was, one, you mentioned the size and you passed on some younger rams. I'm just curious, with these general season over the counter tags as a resident, is there any sort of restriction on age class, size or anything above?
So in Alberta, where I do like most of my sheep hunting, there's no age restriction, but there is a curl restriction. So it has to be at least 4/5 curl.
Okay.
And what that means is, like, just to describe it with like simply, is the tip of the horn and the front base need to be at the front of the eye.
Yeah.
So, you know, on a big horn, that's not necessarily the easiest thing to get either, just because the older sheep do broom so heavy. So if you get you can see, or a lot of guys shoot young rams just because that lamb tip isn't broke off. And, you know, you might even get a 5-year-old that's a full curl, but he's not a very old sheep. And it's really not the kind of ram you want to take out of the population. So if you can find a truly like 8-year-plus old ram that makes that 4/5 requirement, that's a pretty good sheep.
Mm-hmm. So on that 4/5 requirement, is there like a way to do an exact measurement on that, or is it kind of just subjective to, I mean, you're in the field and you're guessing, and you know what happens if you're off by 1/4 inch?
If you're off by 1/4 inch, your worst nightmares will come true. I know in BC, you turn yourself in, you know, there's a little bit of leeway, but in Alberta, they're pretty strict on it. Like if you're short, you are in a lot of trouble, and you usually end up with a court date and a big fine. So a lot of rams are shot like right on the line, or not much past that 4/5. But I mean, like, you're you're spending some serious time behind the glass before you make that call if it's that close. So, you want to be very sure that what you're taking is going to is legal and going to make it. And most guys I talk to, like, unless it's like, you know, you look at it and it's like a no brainer, they'll probably look at a ram for 2 to 2.5 hours before they decide to go after it and make sure it's legal and look at it from every angle and both sides, because usually one side's broomed a little heavier than the other, but the long side, you want to make good and sure that when you bring it in to get registered, there's no questions whatsoever.
Makes spending $3,000 on a spotting scope a pretty easy decision.
That's probably the most important tool you have in the field for sure, is that spotting scope. Like, that's one place I don't recommend saving money or weight on.
Very cool. One other quick question. I'm sure we could probably turn this topic into an episode alone, but, you know, just, I got to thinking of it because you mentioned, you know, your friend had this area that he wanted to go check out. When I picture steep country, I mean, you just think, you know, super high country, steep, just, you know, shale, all kinds of stuff. Mm-hmm. What is it that you are looking for when you're scouting an area for sheep? In terms of terrain or habitat features, or is it simply a matter of getting in there, covering ground, and seeing where they are?
I probably, like most modern-day backcountry guys, and check out Google Earth first. And what you're really looking for is high alpine meadows with steep cliffs for an escape terrain. Wherever I've found rams, in particular, there's always an escape route and cliffs that they can get to easily from that alpine meadows. And I've been into areas that I thought, oh, this would be the absolute perfect sheep habitat and whatnot. And you get there and there's not a sheep to be found. There's usually some elk or whatever wandering around, but there's never any sheep. And when I've really gone back and looked at my pictures and whatnot, it really dawned on me that if they don't have that cliffy area and the escape terrain, they're not going to be there regardless of how good the habitat is. So that's kind of the first thing I look for. And our mountains here, when you're going into them, you're typically going up, or you're following like a horse or a game trail up a river valley to the headwaters. And then once you get off to the headwaters or to the area that you want to hunt, then that's when you kind of get off the valley floor, I guess. And so sometimes you're really, like, if the, depending on how thick the forest is, you're really walking blind and really relying on your map to know exactly how far you've gone in before you kind of break out of that valley floor up into the high country. So
yeah,
what's kind of the average distance you got to do on most of your hunts?
On the DIY stuff on foot, I've gone as little as 4 miles and, oh man, up to over 20. So you can get pretty deep. Unless you are hunting with a partner and really know what you're getting into, I don't recommend going that deep typically, just because if you do get something, getting it out's a whole nother issue altogether.
So after like 6-7 years of hunting sheep DIY, passing some and then getting a ram, you actually ventured into guided hunts, and that's a bit, you know, what we want to talk about tonight from several aspects. But first, why did you make that jump after being, a do-it-yourself hunter for all these years and really get into going guided?
Yeah, so the biggest reason I kind of started looking into using an outfitter was I just didn't have time to do my own scouting properly in an area. And especially like with these backcountry areas, like it's not like you can drive the pickup down the road and, get off a little ways and pull out the spotting scope. Like you're committed for at least 2-3 days to go into an area here. And and scout things out. And, you know, with my job, I was just getting busier and busier. And then, you know, children come and you just don't have the time to spend in there. The other thing I found, too, that those that the older I got doing the DIY stuff, it's just harder and harder to carry more weight to make camp comfortable. And, you know, using some of these guide services or drop camps, you have a you've got horses, and you can actually have a nice wall tent with maybe like a little wood stove in it, and you can bring good food and not just eat in Mountain House. It just like, and when you get there too, you're just not as tired or worn out when you start hunting, when you have the horses available and stuff. So that's kind of how I got into it. And I had one real kind of bad DIY backpack experience that got me kind of investigating that stuff. And it was actually a Dall sheep trip in Alaska. And I shouldn't say it was a DIY. It was guided, but it was basically DIY. We were on backpacks for 21 days. And by day 21, I was pretty pretty tired. And, you know, that was just an incredible amount of time to be hiking around the mountains with nothing but your backpack and eating Mountain House. And by the time we got out there, I think I was on the last notch in my belt because we'd lost so much weight. But
yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah, that was pretty intense trip. So I started looking into, like I said, guides and outfits that had horses and seeing what it kind of cost to do that. So
yeah. So you've kind of touched on it, but obviously there's varying levels of assistance, if you will, from a fully guided hunt where the hunting process is actually guided,
yeah,
you know, even to something that's, you know, essentially a drop camp. And that's consistent up there. I know that that's the case for lower 48. You know, if you go to look at an elk hunt, for example, you can get a drop camp, you can get a fully guided hunt. There's variations in between, but
yeah,
that's consistent up there as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, at home here in Alberta, there's quite a few outfits that offer locals drop camp options, and some of them will actually even bring you in and set up the camp and stay there and tend the horses and camp, and then if you get something, they'll come out and pick it, like, you know, help you get it off the mountain and back to camp. And then there's some that you're basically on a guided hunt, but it's costing you a fraction of the cost because you have your own tag in your hand, and they don't have to use one of their sheep allocations on you. So yeah, there's quite a few different options, but like I said, I really like, if it's up to me, especially the older I'm getting, I really just like having the use of horses and good meals, like, you know, being able to pack in good food and more than just Mountain House every day, I guess. So
yeah for sure. So on the side of a fully guided hunt, we actually have a guide to assist you in the hunting process. You know, there's a lot of pride in guys who are do-it-yourself hunters, but, you know, especially for us guys in the lower 48, if we wanted to get into species like sheep, I mean, the fact is the opportunities expand dramatically if you can go guided, right?
Yeah, for sure.
So there's this, you know, there's this idea, and it sounds ridiculous to say it out loud, but I've heard so many hunters either say it blatantly or echo the thoughts that, you know, going on a guided hunt is guaranteeing success, or it's, you know, it's taking the chance out of the chase or what have you. Can you kind of just speak to that and still give us some realities of how difficult it is to still hunt even if you're fully guided?
Yeah, so guided is definitely not guaranteed. You know, I think if I was going to say there was a guaranteed guided hunt, it would have to be maybe a black bear hunt or maybe a white-tailed deer hunt over a feeder, but that's as close as to guaranteed as you're going to get. If you're actually going backcountry hunting, it's still, it's really just hunting. And, you know, what you're relying on the guide for is his knowledge, local knowledge of the area. So it's typically, like, especially in these sheep hunts, if you're going to BC or the Yukon or Alaska, you definitely are not going there beforehand on several scouting trips to figure the area out. So you're really relying on the guide for knowledge of the area, where to look, And you know, it's a different species for most guys too. Like, the average guy doesn't hunt sheep every year. They're lucky to hunt them once or twice in a lifetime if they get the tag. And hunting sheep is like hunting a deer. It's just like not hunting an elk. It's not like hunting any other species. So they're specialized kind of hunting skills or knowledge that you're relying on as well. And if you are lucky enough to pull a once in a lifetime sheep tag, I don't think you want to go out there and try to years to pull your tag. But that being said, I've got several friends that are guides in BC and Alberta and the Yukon, and they all have the same, they all say the same thing. They say, you know, the hunt is for the hunter is really what he makes it. If he wants to just hang back at camp and just be the trigger man, so, but more often than not, especially on the sheep hunts, the guys that are coming to hunt them want to participate in the hunt. They want to glass, they want to look for sheep, they want to try to find them. They want to be there every step of the way with the guides. So on these guided trips, I think a lot of it depends on the person going. Like, if you want to, you can make it as hard or as easy as you want. And when I say as easy as you want, you know, I've heard lots of stories about guys that just want to sit in camp until the guides actually found an animal for them to go and see. But most of the guys I know that have ever went on any kind of guided trip have tried to be active participants for sure. So,
yeah. So just diving into it, there's so much we can cover on this, but what do we begin to look for and begin to consider as we plan an outfitted or guided hunt, and specifically when we're weighing options on, you know, the various outfitters and guides to go with? I mean, what are some of the key questions we should be asking as we do our research?
Well, that's a great question, because when I first started looking into this stuff, you know, it seemed like there was the same service offered from, you know, price points all over the map, and I couldn't really figure out, why is this guy so much cheaper than that guy, and why is this guy so much more expensive than this other guy? It looks like you're getting the same thing. But when you really start diving into it, you kind of get what you pay for, just like anything else. So a few of the questions you'll want to ask is, number one, like, how are you accessing the area? Like, is it horse? Is it ATV? Is it plane? Is it riverboat? Because, you know, some guys, they want a horseback hunt, or some guys aren't comfortable with horses. Some guys want to show up in a pickup truck. You know, it's, you really got to find out how they're getting to their area. Another question is, you know, what kind of camp do you have? Is it cat? Because what I've found is a lot of the pictures on some of these websites aren't necessarily what's there with when you, once you get to camp. So, you know, you really want to find out, are we staying in a cabin? Are we hunting from the cabin? Are we hunting from wall tents? Is it backpack-style tents? You know, really, what are the accommodations? And then the other one, big one, is food. Like, are we eating Mountain House three meals a day? Are we having Mountain House occasionally? Are we eating steak? That's a really important aspect too, and a lot of people I don't think really think about that piece of it, but you know, as you guys know, if you're backpack hunting, eating at the Mountain House, you're kind of starving to death every day. You just can't eat, you just can't eat enough food, right? So
yeah,
it's really important to know what you're getting for your money. The other piece too is knowing the area that that outfitter operates. So are you planning on relying on him to bring you into this area and kind of know where things are, or are you, do you have a specific spot you want that guy to take you? If you have this very specific spot you want to go and hunt, you know, a drop camp is probably the best option for that kind of a hunter, because you can say, take me here. The guy can come and drop you off, make plans for him to stay and tend your camp for you, or plan for him to come back in, you know, a week and pick you up or whatnot. But, you know, I tend to try to figure out exactly where I want to go before I go into a place. So I'm not relying on someone else to hopefully take me to a good spot. But, yeah, so for drop camp is probably a good option for a guy that really knows where they want to go and get to, but just maybe can't get there on foot for whatever reason that might be.
Yeah. So speak a bit about pricing, because, I mean, as you kind of mentioned, there's prices all over the map, but I've noticed as well, just on some very rudimentary research, that, you know, a guide will price their hunts much differently, you know, doing things like a flat fee for essentially getting you there, and then, you know, trophy fees and add-ons based on the species you take versus paying up front for, you know, certain species included. I mean, kind of talk us through the different pricing options for things, you know, like what animals you take, as well as the post-hunt care of those trophies and other fees.
Okay. Yeah, so... this could be a whole episode on its own, but
Give us an idea of what to look for, because it's just overwhelming.
Yeah, if you are going on a fully 100% guided trip with an outfitter, like, you know, say it's not in your home state or province, and you're just basically showing up and doing the trip, I've done a couple of those trips because I've hunted sheep in a few other places. And what I would say is get the base price of a trip for a single species, and then anything extra, just have preset trophy fees if that's what you're going to do. Some guys like to negotiate an all-in price with like two or three species in it. But what I've found is talking to quite a few different people is, if you do that up front, typically you don't get two or three species, but if you got them on more of like a trophy type basis, you're probably going to be a little more successful, and if you're not, you're not out anything extra. So that's what I would personally recommend anyways. Other guys have different opinions, but the other thing too, when you're negotiating some of this stuff, you really got to find out what's included. So if there's a charter flight involved, is that extra or is that included? The other piece too, like you're mentioning, the after hunt trophy care. Myself, I always pack it, all my stuff with me and bring it home. I never leave it there. I know lots of guys like the outfitter to handle it. Just because it's easier when you're at the end of the hunt just to jump on the plane, head home, and, you know, not have to worry about figuring out how to get a set of elk antlers back on the plane or caribou or whatever you're hunting, and then the meat too. Lots of guys that go on these trips, they don't bring much, if any, of it back, so they just want the outfitter to handle all that and send it back. But myself personally, I bring everything as check baggage. So I'll give you guys a couple stories. So when we went to Alaska, when we came back, we stopped by Walmart, got a couple blue bins, put our sheep in the blue bins and the capes, duct taped them all up, wrote our names and addresses on them, and they just slapped a baggage label on them and checked them right through, right to our home airport. So it worked really well that way.
So you didn't have to declare that as anything special necessarily?
Well, what we did, since we were from out of country, was we went to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife office, which is in the old airport right beside the main terminal there. And we talked to those guys, and they said, well, for those species that we had, we didn't need like any special export permits out of the United States. And my buddy and I were like, you know what? We don't trust our customs people at home. Just give us those export permits regardless. Yeah. So he's like, all right. And, he filled them out. And so we had one for a sheep, and my buddy had a caribou as well. But, you know, if it was a bear or, a CITES animal, we would have had to get those permits no matter what. But when we came home, it was no problem. We just basically walked through customs, and they said, oh, well, someone's obviously checked these animals because he had these export permits, so away you go kind of thing. Huh. The other time that I went on kind of like a big trip that required a lot of, you know, extra plane rides and whatnot, because Alaska, you know, once you get to Anchorage, that's just the first step in that journey. The next one is finding the next plane that takes you out to the bush or whatever. But was that the next hunt after that that I did that was kind of logistically challenged was in Newfoundland for a woodland caribou, actually. And I was lucky enough to get a caribou out there. And then on the way home, I figured, oh, I'll do the same thing. I'll put the meat in blue bins, check it on the plane. So that was all great. And then we had, I thought I'd put the rack in a basically a hockey bag that I had with me that I carry a lot of my gear in. And then I was like, oh, this won't fit in here. I ended up having to split the skull on it and got it in and back, luckily, in one piece. But the big nightmare on that trip, though, because I took all the meat home on it, and the outfitter actually had some freezers at his camp, so we froze it all, and it was kind of like good to go and wasn't worried about it thawing. But the big challenge on that was my wife and kids were waiting for me at out east, and I was picking them up, and we were just going to head home back to Alberta here, and we got laid over in Toronto, which is like about halfway home. So I had like 12 between the suitcases and blue bins and rifle and all the rest of it, I had about 12 pieces of luggage. So we got held up in Toronto overnight. So I was trying to deal with 12 pieces of luggage, and I had like, I think I had something like three of those carts that carry your luggage at the airport. Yeah. And two kids, and holy man, it was a nightmare. But that was probably about the only real bad experience I've had with traveling and hunting. Anyways, bringing the meat back, if I wouldn't have brought the meat back, you know, it wouldn't have been that bad. But you know, I had several blue bins full of caribou meat. And
so that was frozen solid at camp. And did you pack any dry ice or anything in those blue bins with it, or just
No, I didn't. And actually, you know what I've really found, and I've flown quite a few times now with meat, is that once, it doesn't matter where you are, whether it's in Houston, Texas, or Alaska, once that plane's at 30,000 feet, it's so cold up there, that stuff does not thaw out whatsoever. Biggest thing is, if you land and it's going to be warm at your destination, you'll just want to get home as soon as possible. But I've traveled a few times with frozen capes and frozen meat, and I've never had it even begin to thaw. When I got home and pulled the lid open, I was like, oh geez, this is still frozen solid. So and like I said, I think it's really just because the plane's at, you know, 30,000 feet and it's cold up there regardless time of year. So
yeah. I know you guys had some interesting adventures, Steve, when you were getting meat and like Jason's moose back and things like that. What lessons did you guys learn when you went to Alaska last year, and what would you maybe do different in the future?
It was pretty much all along the same lines. What Chris is saying here is just we elected to ship use the outfitter to take care of the meat and ship it, and it was just kind of a pain in the butt because, you know, communication was tough and we didn't know what was going on. But we had not wished we had done essentially what Chris did there, is just freeze it, because they did have the option for that, and throw it in boxes and take it home, because it would have saved you a lot of money. B, you would have known you got your meat back, because, you know, you just never know what happens when it gets shipped off with a bunch of other people's meat.
Yeah,
it would have been the way better option to go. You might not have been able to bring all of it back, just from a logistics standpoint, unless you wanted 12 blue bins to lug around.
Yeah.
But it would have been, I think, the better option for sure. So if I ever do something again, that's definitely what I'm going to do.
Like when I was in Alaska too, I just found it was just chaos up there during hunting season. Like hunters are coming and going. There's rocks laying out the side of these regional airports. And you're just like, how does anybody get their stuff if they leave it here? I was just like, it's just anybody that has been there kind of gets it. But, you know, planes in Alaska are like cars are everywhere else. Like there's people flying here and there, and it's amazing to me that anyone gets their stuff back if they don't bring it home, to be honest with you. So I just found Alaska too, it just seemed really unorganized compared to other places I've hunted. And what I mean by that is, like, you know, anybody can hang their shingle out, and some guys are better than others, obviously, but it just seemed like we, as the hunters that had come there, were making a lot of our own arrangements that typically other places the outfitter would take care of. So I'm not sure what you found, Steve, but that was kind of our experience there anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Awesome. So backing up to some of the process of, you know, guys who are beginning to look into a guided hunt or an outfitted hunt. You know, there's services out there so that, you know, you as the hunter aren't, you know, even having to do all of the research of finding the right guide or the right spot. There's hunting consultants, if you will, that will sort of match the hunt you're looking for to a guide. What kind of just talk us through the advantages that those offer and maybe some things to look out for if one chooses to look into a hunting consultant to basically place them with a guide.
Yeah, no, that's a great question, because I actually looked into that a little bit myself quite a few years ago, just like talked to some people actually from Cabela's Tags back in the day, and I really didn't find them to be overly knowledgeable on everything. Like they were generalists, but like they could find you an outfit to hunt with, but they didn't necessarily know that, you know, outfitter A and this region, this is great, he's this and this, and I've been there, and you know, they just really did, they weren't knowledgeable about that specific hunt they were trying to sell. But then other consultants, they only book for a handful of outfits and are very knowledgeable with what you're getting into when you go with them. So that's kind of one thing to really be wary of is, are you booking with just like a, I'm going to call it more or less a travel agency, or are you booking with a consultant that really knows what he's sending you into? And actually, I do a little bit of freelance consulting for the Magnum Hunt Club a little bit as well, just for a couple trips. But, you know, I see a big difference between kind of what they do and what, say, like a Cabela's Tags type of service does. So, the one thing you can tell, though, is if they're just trying to sell you something, they probably don't know as much about that outfit as what some of these other places do.
Mm-hmm. So I guess some of those same questions we talked about earlier that we need to ask when looking for a guide, we should be, you know, peppering these hunting consultants with those questions and making sure that they can come up with legit answers and aren't just fumbling over a sales pitch.
Yeah, like if they can tell you that they've been there and that their experience was X, Y, and Z, you know, that means something. But if they're just like, oh, this is a good outfit or that's a good outfit based on a customer ratings kind of thing, you know, that's, to me, it's a night and day difference. Like if the guy can actually say, yeah, down this fork in the drainage, they got this cabin and it's set up and this is where we found our moose, and this is, you know, if they actually have some real knowledge, then that's probably a guy that you could book with. And if it's more or less like, oh, this is a good region and this guy's got a good reputation, you know, it might work out great, but the guy you're booking with really doesn't understand the area or what he's sending you into. So,
yeah. So one more option that I kind of see out there is this availability essentially of cancellation hunts. Can you kind of explain what those is, how that process works, and again, kind of the pros and cons of maybe looking at that method to book a hunt?
So cancellation hunts are, to me, like the best thing ever. but everybody and their dog goes to these shows and says, put me on your cancellation list, put me on your cancellation list. And like I said, I've got several friends that are guides and own outfits and whatnot. And most of them have the same story. Like, we got to call 15 people before anyone, or maybe 100 people before they find someone that was on their cancellation list that's actually serious. Like, what I would recommend for someone that's serious about doing one of these hunts, but maybe doesn't have the money just to write the big check and go whenever they want, is to figure out what you want to hunt, where you want to hunt it, and who you want to hunt it with. So if you're looking for a doll sheep in the Mackenzie Mountains and that is your dream hunt of a lifetime, you know, there's really only two or three outfitters that provide that hunt. Pick the one that you really want to go with. Give the guy a call up and say, look, put me on your cancellation list and I'll give you a couple $1,000 to be the first guy that you call. Like, or put it like a small deposit, like a couple $1,000 down and say, I'm going with you, but call me. I'm the first guy when this cancellation comes up. And I could almost guarantee you'll be the first guy they call every time, because that shows you're serious. The only downside is at that point you are committed to going with that outfit. So choose wisely. But I bet you of all the guys I know, there's hardly a one that doesn't have at least one cancellation a year. Mm-hmm. So the chance to go on one is great. You just have to make sure that your schedule is extremely flexible as well, though. Like, if you need to give your boss 2 weeks notice before you go on holidays or more, it might be tough, because some of these trips, they're literally a guy dropped out. If you can come Monday morning, you know, there's a spot for you, kind of thing. So the more flexible you can be, the better off you are as well. But I think, you know, there's two or three places I really would like to go and that I'm buddies with the operators, and the one guy's called me every year for the last couple of years, and it's usually the same story. Like, oh, I had a couple doctors that were coming up this or next week. They just phoned me today and said they're not coming and they lost all their money. Do you want to come up and just go hunting? And there's basically, if you're ready to go, there's some great deals to be had out there. So
yeah. So this will obviously vary based upon the species and timing and all kinds of things, but what kind of money can be saved by going on a cancellation hunt? And not necessarily a dollar amount, but say like 25% or 50% or...
I've seen some hunts up to easily 75% off. Wow. A sheep hunt in particular, easy 75% off if it's last minute. So, you know, because usually what happens is you have so much time to pay for these trips before the date, and if a guy opts out within 2 to 4 weeks of going, they're not getting any of their money back. So you can save a lot. I would say easily, at a minimum, I would say at least, if they're not going to give you at least 25 to 50% off at a minimum, I would pass it up.
Yeah. And I guess at that point too, there's maybe no harm in sort of counter offering, if you will. Like, yeah, I can make it for, you know, 50% off, but not 25.
Yeah, for sure. And the only time they wouldn't go for it is if whoever they booked, say, didn't give them that much money down and never made any, didn't pay for the trip, basically, and they really can't sell it for any less than they're asking. But 9 times out of 10, you can really go for pennies on the dollar. So, but like I said, you have to be ready to go at a moment's notice usually. And, whatnot and have a pretty flexible schedule. But if you do, man, it's the way to go on a trip of a lifetime.
Yeah.
So.
Seems like a pretty decent option to get on that list if you, I don't know, say you like run a pack company or something, Steve. You could just
yeah, exactly.
Like, yeah, I can get out of office for a week. I don't know. Of course, yeah. I say that, and it's like the busiest time of the year for you. Yeah. So of course,
I'm being August 1st.
Yeah.
Yeah, but, yeah. I guess with the pack business, it's probably pretty seasonal for the most part. So
yeah, summers are definitely crazy.
Yeah. So let's talk a bit about, you know, we've planned this hunt, and our proverbial hunters made all the arrangements. The time comes to hunt. They get to the destination, and from there, you know, maybe there's this idea that it's all just the outfitter pampering the hunter, but talk a little bit about the mindset the hunter should have, the expectations that they should have going into it, and really the part that they still have to play. Like, they're not just there as some diva to be cared for, right?
Yeah. And that's an interesting topic. A really good friend of mine's a sheep guide. And he's had the whole gamut of the guy that wants to show up to camp and just bring me up the mountain when you find my ram, to you know, the guy that is hunting with them just like they're two buddies on the mountain, you know, both doing equally as same amount of work. But my personal and I've told lots of guys this that are going on these or plan on going on these trips is to do whatever you can to help your guide or the wrangler or whoever it is. So, you know, if that means doing dishes, yeah, sure, you don't have to do them. That's what you paid these guys for. But that's going to make those guys' job that much easier. It's going to allow them to get a few other things done. You know, the other thing you can do, like, you know, if they're saddling horses, you can take the brush and just brush them down before they put the saddles on. That saves you 5 minutes. Anything you can do to help your guys out, because you're in it together. It doesn't matter if you paid or not. You know, if you aren't helping out, you're basically, in my opinion, losing hunting time. So whether that's chopping firewood, helping out, making a meal here and there, fetching some water, whatever it is, wherever you can help out, you're just going to have a better hunt. And you know what? Those guides appreciate it too, because they're used to clients that are showing up and, you know, pull up the lawn chair, put their feet up, and they're waiting on these guys hand and foot. And, you know, there's clients that do that on a regular basis. But if you're in there and you're helping those guys and treating them like human beings and not just like a servant, they're going to work extra hard for you as well. So being a decent human being goes a long way. So,
yeah. So what about, and again, I know this varies, but just to help give us an idea, the hunt goes down and time's up and a tag goes unfilled. You know, I've seen different sort of formal and informal policies on an unsuccessful hunt and what a guide might offer. In that scenario, kind of talk us through what you've seen and experienced and what one might expect or should at least consider maybe even when booking a guide based on such policies.
Yeah. So if I would say probably 95 plus percent of outfits will tell you, your hunt is your hunt. If you don't get something, well, that's hunting. From all the guys that I've talked to and just my own experience, if you go and you are an active participant and you are trying your hardest with their guide and you don't have an opportunity, they will usually bring you back if they're any kind of outfit at all. Sometimes they don't have an option to do that, like if it's say like a sheep or whatever, like usually their tags are sold out well ahead of time, but usually they will get you an opportunity to at least take a shot. If you've had an opportunity or two on the trip and you just weren't able to get something, you know, they might cut, they typically would cut the guy a break and bring them back for a discounted rate the following year. So, now that being said, like I was talking about treating people like decent human beings, I know a few guys that have not been so decent, and the outfitter basically says pay full price or you're not coming back. So, you know, it's really, there's no one hard and fast rule, but it's, you know, the more you can build your relationships with these people, the better deal you're probably going to get yourself at the end of the day.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, that's kind of been my experience anyways with things and with the guys I've talked to.
Yeah. So one more point or question I had on sort of our responsibility or the part we play as hunters is the whole idea of tipping and how that's handled for, you know, the outfitter and supporting staff. And again, I don't think there's like a rule here, but just kind of talk us through your experiences and what you've seen, and what, you know, the guides that you know, kind of what are they looking for? Are they expecting it? Just give us a feel for that whole arrangement.
Yeah. So, this is a really hotly debated topic, and I've had a lot of people ask me like what the rule is. Is it a percentage? Is it a set amount? Is it a max? And I, you know, most guys I talk to, it's like, okay, if it's a percentage, just think about that for a minute. Say the magic number is 5%. If that trip of a lifetime cost you $40,000 or $50,000, at 5%, that's a lot of tip money. Yeah. at the end of it, right?
Yeah.
But I guess I guess people that are paying that kind of money for those trips, maybe they can afford it. But and the guides that I've talked to, you know, they've said they've got everything from gear and no cash to cash and gear to cash, but you know, it really depends on the price of the hunt for, I'd say, the max that people are giving. But also the quality of service too. So like if a guy was terrible, I tell people, you know, a tip is for exceptional service. It's not for standard service, and it's not just an automatic give me. So if the guy was like terrible and you were picking up 85% of the slack and you found your own animals and he didn't even pack it out for you, you know, maybe you don't give him anything, right? But if the guy was like, you know, doing double time for you every day and helped you really be successful and was packing your sheep off the mountain in the middle of a blizzard, yeah, you know, maybe it's worth giving him a little extra if you have it. But I don't want to say a set number, but I know on a caribou hunt in Newfoundland, I've heard the rule, I think, was something like 200 for the guide and 100 for the cook or something like that. So that's probably on the lower end, but they're doing a volume business there. On a sheep hunt, my one friend that's a guide in BC there, he's gotten as much as $2,000. So I think the range is all over the map. It's really what the hunter can afford and what he feels like he got for service. But then on the other hand, the same buddy in BC there, he's been given gifts, like a $3,500 pair of Leica binoculars. So, you know, like the guy bought him for the trip and he's like, oh, here you go, I'm getting a new pair next year. And, you know, so there's intangible things like that. And I know some of these guys too, especially in the sheep hunting world, like it's a pretty small community. And, you know, this one guide that I know in particular, he's had people from Florida bring him down there in the wintertime to spend a month with them at their place, hanging out by the pool kind of thing. So
wow.
There's lots of like little fringe and perk benefits that that people give out to, but I'd say the average guy is probably looking at, you know, probably a cash tip, I would think. But
yeah. That's interesting. Very interesting. Yeah. So are there any other topics we didn't cover or anything that comes to mind just from a, I know there's a lot more to talk about, but from a very high level for guys who are just sort of interested in maybe someday or just exploring getting into a guided or an outfitted hunt, anything that pops out that we didn't cover?
Yeah, the one thing that I would recommend is, like, the first outfitted hunt I did was a huge trip, and it was Alaska. That is the wrong trip to start out with. The trip you want to start out with is do like an antelope hunt, do a black bear hunt, do something small. Figure out what question, like, you know, you think you've asked all the right questions, you think you've did all your homework, but what you're going to find is when you go on your first trip with one of these outfits, there's going to be things that come up that, like, oh, next time I'm going to ask about this, and next time I'm going to ask about that, and start small, figure out the logistics of actually traveling with your firearm or your bow or whatnot, because that's a whole different ball of wax too than just throwing your gun in the truck and heading out. There's a lot of little things that you don't really think about when you go on your first guided hunt, I guess. So I would definitely recommend do something small that's affordable. And then if you do get completely burnt, it's not like you lost the family farm kind of thing. So
that's great advice. Yeah.
Yeah. You almost make a practice run and still get to chase something.
Yeah, exactly. And you know what? I tell people all the time too, a really great first outfitted hunt is do a caribou. It is, I just really enjoy hunting them. I don't know why. It's not that hard of a hunt to start with. Your odds of success are extremely high, and it is a true adventure. Like, where you have to travel to go to get these things is a ton of logistics and you know, a ton of plane changes, and that'll really give you a good feel for what's involved in it, and they're not that expensive of a trip, all things considered.
That's so. Yeah, we might have to talk offline about that one.
We definitely should. Yeah. Because actually, I've organized a group trip for 8 of us just through my office for Nunavut in 2018 for caribou, and then been asked to organize another one for possibly Quebec here. So yeah, definitely talk offline if you want after about it. So
cool, very cool. So we appreciate the time. I just got to know, you know, given the experiences that you've had both with your, you know, your DIY hunting and even the guided hunting, just, you know, it's another level to hunt in sheep country. And as you mentioned, you kind of learned the hard way from a gear perspective. Just a few highlights of some of the lessons you've learned or some of the gear items that have proven invaluable over the years for you.
Oh, man.
I know there's a bunch. I know we're running on time, but just some of the highlights.
Okay. Like, I'd say the top 3 or 4 things, the right pack for you, that is absolutely critical. And what I mean by that is, you know, there's a handful of high-end backpacks out there. I've kind of run through almost all of them at this point, just trying them and seeing what I like best. But certain ones, you know, I absolutely hate the harnesses on, but my buddy, that was the best fitting pack he ever put on for him. You just want to make sure that the pack's made with a good quality, like good quality. And when you got weight in it, it carries properly on your frame, like on your body. So that's probably, probably one of the key pieces there. Second, but not really a second, is boots. Investing in a good pair of mountain boots is just a lifesaver. Like, I didn't realize how big of a difference that made until I actually got a pair of good proper mountain boots. You know, I went from having blisters after every trip to I haven't had a blister since I've got these boots. So that's a huge thing there.
Yeah, I know that's very personal as well, because everybody has different feet. But what is your boot of choice, out of curiosity?
Mine is the Handwag Alaska GTX.
Okay.
And that's kind of similar to, I think, a Kenetrex or a Lower, similar to those, but just fits my foot perfect, and I've never had any issues with them.
Gotcha.
But my buddy that I actually went to Alaska with there, he had them. They weren't wide enough for him. He had blisters all the time with them, but he got a pair of, I think it was the Kenetrex, and they fit him perfect. So, like you said, it's a very personal choice. Mm-hmm. Just make sure you have a good quality boot that's not going to fall apart on you.
Yeah.
So that'd be my second piece of gear. The third and fourth would be a good set of rain gear and some kind of a good shelter, whether it's a bivy sack or a tent or a whatever. Man, that makes a huge difference. Yeah.
And what are your preferences there as well?
Oh, the tents. I don't like the weight, but the Hillebergs I really like. I've tried quite a few different ones, like the MSRs and whatnot. But man, that Hillberg, my one friend that guides there, he bought one for himself personally, and I don't think there's a better three-season tent that I've tried for backpacking anyway. But like I said, it's probably pound and a half heavier than what maybe something equivalent in an MSR might be. Mm-hmm. Just way more comfortable and way more rainproof, and just seemed to be
worth the wait.
Yeah, definitely worth it. Yeah. Being comfortable is nice when it's miserable out. So
yeah.
Yeah. How about you guys? What are you guys running for tents?
Kind of all over. I know, Steve, you're a Hillberg fan, and have, you know, mm-hmm. depending on the season, I mean, like this year, you know, we were in September archery season. We were running a floorless tent from Seek Outside, kind of a teepee style shelter. But you know, it's obviously we weren't in sheep country either.
Yeah, well, I've been looking at those teepee tents from Seek. There, I'm tempted to try them out. I did have kind of like a cheap teepee tent that was made out of just like basically tarp that you'd find mm-hmm. at any store, and man, I sure liked how easy it was to set up, and
yeah,
it just seemed like, but like you say, you got to have a spot that's flat that you can't really pitch it on a incline at all. So
right, yeah, it's the second year we've used that for elk season, and it's worked out really well for us.
Yeah. Yeah, you just seem to have you can't really stand up a whole lot in them, but they just seem to have a lot of square footage on the ground that's covered, it seems like, for what you get and whatnot. So
yeah, for sure. Yeah. Well, Chris, we are at some time, man. We so appreciate taking the time that you did, and just, you know, there's so much knowledge in here that I'm sure guys are going to reap the rewards of as they look to, you know, doing a guided hunt, whether that's next year, even in, you know, 5-10 years down the road. It's super valuable just to get a taste of what we need to know and look for.
Yeah, no, for sure. And, you know, the one thing too that a lot of people think is that if you go on a guided trip that, like you said, it's a give me and that it's expensive and it's these rich guys wanting to guarantee a trophy. It doesn't have to be like that, and it doesn't have to be expensive. So, you know, just figure out what you really want to go after and look at all your options. And, you know, there's usually the average guy can harvest at least one of every species type in North America if you have an average job. You don't need to be a doctor. You don't need to be, you know, an engineer. You just have to pick what you want to go after, focus on it, and work towards that goal, I guess.
Well, I think that is a great place to leave this episode. Again, thank you guys so much for tuning in. As always, you can send your questions, comments, or feedback to us at podcast@exomountaingear.com. Also, a big shout out to Rusty Truman. You were this week's Exo Mountain Gear swag winner. If you can send us your address to podcast@exomountaingear.com, we'll be sure to send you out some goodies. Listeners, if you want to get in on these giveaways, it's really simple. Just, we appreciate those iTunes reviews. Or if you can't do that, again, just email us with your questions, comments, or feedback. We just love to hear from you. So until next time, guys, great episodes coming up. Happy hunting. Hope you can get outdoors. We will catch you for the next episode.